front of them.
Oh, so good evening, and thanks very much for moving in. It's great to be here and great to have you all here with us tonight. We welcome you to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name's Judy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Judy.
For those of you who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize that the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing the second part of step four. So we'll be covering the fear and sex sections of the fourth step. And can everybody hear okay? Okay, good. I will turn the meeting over to David.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
David.
Grateful to be here and grateful to be sober tonight. We always try to point out, we don't have it codified in the format or written in a way, just in a conversational way. We like to mention what we're trying to do and what we're not trying to do here. We're absolutely not here to teach anybody anything. We're not big book experts. There's plenty of people in the room that know a lot more about the big book than I know. What we're simply trying to do is have a big book based step study and share our experience, strength, and hope on the step. And that's what we're endeavoring to do. And that's all we're endeavoring to do. So that's what we hope to do. So we're going to start off tonight on page 68. The inventory is divided into three clear parts: resentments, fear, and selfish sex conduct. So we did resentments last week, and so we're going to start on fears. Top of page 68, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. So I'm a guy who absolutely loved drinking. Alcohol was a spiritual experience for me when it worked. And if it still worked the way it worked when I was 14 years old, I'd probably still be doing it right now. Trouble is it doesn't, for me, it stopped working that way. It stopped being the magic thing. It stopped making me fit in my own skin and feel all right and comfortable wherever I was. And I wish I could say that it stopped doing that and I came to AA and got sober, but it was a 6-year trip for me from my first AA meeting to what I hope to be my last white chip. I got sober when I was 28. I'll be 52 in a couple of weeks. And for somebody who wasn't expecting to live past 30, that's not a bad deal. You know, and when I got here, I would have described myself as somebody who didn't have any fears. I'm not afraid of anything. I had all the courage that John Barleycorn and Anheuser-Busch could offer a man, and I had plenty of it. It was only through the beating that I took of two real significant beatings. One was basically the beating that alcohol had for me, and then the beating that alcoholism had for me. If anybody can relate to this, I really do believe that I experienced alcoholism when I put the plug in the jug. When I stopped drinking, that's when I start feeling restless, irritable, discontent, uncomfortable. People start looking at me funny. People say things I don't like. Stuff starts arriving in the mail that I don't like. My boss doesn't appreciate me. She's not good enough. That goes on and on and on. And that's the thing that a drink would just make quiet, you know? I could pull up a bar stool and I would know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, I would just suddenly not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. The future was brightening up as we speak, you know. That's what it did for me, until it didn't do that for me anymore. So I took those beatings and finally just became willing to listen, you know. I got here with a lot of preconceived notions, a lot of things that I wouldn't do. So it took 6 years to take that first step and just say, you know what, whatever it is I've got, I can't solve it. The problem that I have, I don't even understand the words you're using, but you guys seem to be doing better than me. I think I'll go along with you. I'll find out what a sponsor is. I'll ask somebody. I'll get a home group. I'll start doing these things. And when you guys helped me through, I was a militant atheist. You guys helped me through with all that. Just the simple actions of AA are going to restore David to sanity. Why don't I make a decision to get on with the rest of the steps, find myself putting pen to paper. And it was at this moment in my recovery when I really had that first glimpse of the I'm going to invent a word here, the immensitude, the absolute scope of the problem that I'm walking around with when I started writing this fear inventory. So we review our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. So I start to write them. And my number one fear, as I write it down, there really is something magic about writing this stuff down, because it's in your handwriting. You put it down there, and now your eyes are looking at what you've written about yourself. There's nobody else in the room. And my number one fear is the fear of being alone. And I do not mean by myself, because I'm kind of a piddler. I have an engineering mind. I'm happy in my own company. You know, I enjoy, you know, doing things and piddling. But when I say alone, what I mean by that is forsaken, just absolutely unloved and friendless and without resource, without pity, without any sort of human compassion or kindness available to me. That's my fear, that's where I'm going to end up, just absolutely, completely, totally alone. And then as I continue, I write my next fear is a fear of people. And now it dawns on me why I need chemicals to survive in the world. Because I'm scared to be alone and I'm scared of people. As I continue to go down this list, I'm scared of all kinds of things that are absolutely 180 degrees apart. You know, I'm scared to death I'm going to be broke. I'm scared to death to work hard. You know, I mean, how am I going to get along? I'm scared she's going to leave. I'm scared she's going to stay. You know, it just goes on and on like that. So it asked me to consider, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And as has been well discussed in here, self-reliance is my number one. I'm my favorite human power. You know, if I got a problem, what do I think about it? You know, and I sit down, I'm going to pull it apart. I'm going to think about what the next right thing to do is. And I'm my go-to guy. Well, it fails me, you know. And you guys would put that really simple for me. It's like, well, that's all very interesting, David. But just remember, your best thinking got you a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd look around and realize that was true. And so self-reliance fails me over and over again. By the time I got here, what was once great self-confidence had been completely broken in me. I was out of answers. I was out of gas. I was ready to take some direction. And that's it.
Okay. Oh. So we asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And I read that for years.
Can you speak up, please?
Yes. Thank you for asking. I've read that over for years. Very familiar with the paragraph. And then I got a new sponsor. And I'm doing the fifth step with her. And she says to me, this is the definition of self-reliance. I've been in AA for all this time, never heard this. And self-reliance is what we do or don't do to keep the fear from coming true. I was like, God, my hair went back. You know, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, here's the profound knowledge about this. And I just I said, that makes all kinds of things fit into place for me. Because I understood what self-reliance meant. I could look it up in the dictionary, read a definition, and say, yeah, I'm self-reliant. I always want to do everything myself, and I don't want to ask anybody for help, and, you know, those are all the standard surface answers to that. And then she said that to me. And I said, oh my God, I never realized that what I was doing, how fear was motivating me in my life, was to be constantly acting to make sure whatever I'm afraid of doesn't happen. And that really is self-reliance. So when my, one of my biggest crisis moments in my sobriety was when my life completely came unraveled and my husband and I separated, and I felt like, not that I was worried about, you know, this is the love of my life. He wasn't. I was really more concerned about my standard of living, to be honest with you. And I was worried that I was going to be, you know, my mind goes right to, I'm going to be a bag lady. This is where I'm going. You know, he's going to leave and I'm going to come completely unglued. And I think he thought that too. And I remember being out with my daughter, and I haven't had a drink in 7 years at this point. I'm out with my daughter, we're trick-or-treating, I absolutely felt like I was having an out-of-body experience. I just was not present. And I wasn't drinking or taking drugs or anything. I was stone cold sober and had completely just couldn't face what was happening in my life. And I was terrified. That was terror, absolute terror. And I did everything I could do to make that not happen. And I couldn't stop the train. You know, the train was on the track and it was going and I couldn't stop it. And I tried all the last ditch efforts, you know, we're gonna go to counseling, we're gonna do this, you know, it's gonna be okay. And what I didn't realize was that he was gone at least 2 years before this event. Before I was experiencing this, it was had already happened. And I didn't know. So I was really afraid, and I was at an end also in my sobriety where I didn't know if I was going to stay sober. I didn't know if I just was really lost, just lost. And it really came clear to me that alcoholism doesn't have a thing to do with alcohol. And it was at that juncture in my life, my sponsor said to me, you do realize you can die of alcoholism without ever taking a drink. I was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? And she said a lot of things to me like, when are you gonna get honest? Honest, what are you talking about? I've gone to 50,000 AA meetings and, you know, started meetings and done service work and what are you saying to me? And it was a very scary place. So what she told me was, you need to get down on your knees with the book in front of you and say to God, I surrender all of it. I don't care who I'm married to. I don't care how much money I have. I don't care where I live. I don't care whether he comes or goes, whether I lose the kid. I don't care. You have all of it. And she said, if you'll surrender like that, you will be picked up and taken care of. And that's exactly what happened to me. Now, it didn't happen to me instantaneously, but that began this process. So this was the surrender that was required to outrun that kind of fear. Because it's that kind of fear that would take me, that could possibly cause me to take a drink. I'm convinced of that, because I was very much on the edge of that. And had I not had somebody in AA who who was very clear about how to work the steps and was very clear about what her own experience was, I would never have survived that. If I had somebody on the other end of the phone saying to me, "Oh, honey, it'll be okay. Don't worry. You can damn well guarantee, excuse me, you can guarantee I would not be sitting here." So I know two things about fear. It can be devastating. It is exactly the way it says in the book. It's an evil encroaching threat. It'll absolutely take your life from you. When you clear the decks, what you're really looking at in alcoholism is this. The underlying thing in all of our defects of character, in all of our troubles, in all of our mental anguish is fear. And I was sober for 2 years before I ever even knew I was afraid of anything. I had lived for so long convincing myself by what I did, just taking terrible, terrible risks and thinking that would, you know, I'm proven to myself I'm not afraid. I was just being crazy stupid is what I was doing. Bad decisions and terrible risks. So it'll take your life, definitely. Way before a drink will, this kind of fear, if it is not subjected to the process of working the steps.
Yeah, and we get here and we talk about just for today, living in today, and it's interesting to me that we've talked about resentments, and you know the resentments really are associated with my judgment of the past, the things that have just gone on, right? I mean, if I'm just for today in this moment, I seem to have a couple of choices other than being in this moment, which is apparently an option. What I would rather do is review the tape from yesterday and document how you fell short, or I run my projector into the future, and I don't know about y'all, but mine is never, it's never good. It's never gonna work out. I don't wake up in the morning and think, oh, it's gonna be a great day. Maybe I should, I don't know. But usually when I'm in the future, it's fear. I'm projecting that I'm not gonna get something that I want, or I'm gonna lose something that I have. And as far as yesterday goes, it's resentment, recrimination, shame. So perhaps there's a better way. We're going to continue on 68. Perhaps there's a better way. I hope so. No, it says we think so. For we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God, and instead we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. Now, it was pointed out to me that that's a prayer. You know, when I recognize that I'm in fear, I can go to the Father and ask him to remove it and direct my thoughts and my attention to what he would have me be. Who can I help? What can I do to be of love and service to my fellows? Thy will, not mine, be done. And it's interesting to me that it says we commence to outgrow fear. The fear problem is not completely solved, apparently, which is what I like. I want a one and done. I want to check the box. I want to move on. But apparently it's been my experience that it gets better over time, you know. And he goes back to, I gotta back up a little bit. We're in the world to play the role he assigns. We're on a different basis. He's taken us back to that keystone idea. Once again on page 62, where he says, you know, right before we took our third step, that we made this decision. We made a decision that hereafter in this drama of life that God was going to be our director, that he's the principal. We are his agents. He's the Father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. And for the longest time, and I know I've shared it before, but it's important to me, and it, you know, for the longest time, I God's the keystone. I get it. You know, you got all these stones. You're trying to make an archway, and you build them up, and you get the right things in place, and then you need a special guy who can cut that stone and drop it in place, and if it's cut just right, that whole structure relaxes on itself, and it's not going anywhere. So this keystone, and I'm like, God is the keystone. I get it. I'm not going anywhere without God. And what he says is that the concept is the keystone, that this attitude is the keystone, that this idea, this simple idea, that hereafter in this drama of life, he's the principal and I'm his agent. I'm in the world to play the role that he assigns. So it's not, the keystone to me, my understanding of it is keystone is not God. The keystone is my attitude about God, my attitude about whether or not I have faith, whether or not I'm willing to play the role that he assigns just for this day. And I have to tell you that that's just not my habit. My habit is to run the show. My habit is to figure my way through, my way out, my way around. You know, can it be avoided? Can it be ignored? Can I power through it? Can I use my brute strength on it? Can I con my way out of it? Can I buy my way out of it? You know, can I pretend it doesn't exist? That's one of my favorite ones. So again, you know, this is my standard mode, and the practice is my attitude about God. Well, if my attitude is one of I am in the world to play the role that he assigns, if that's my attitude, that my purpose is to be of love and service to my fellows, what do I have to worry about tomorrow, next week, next month, next year? You know, when that is present in my mind, what my purpose is, I'm suddenly here. I haven't been here all day, and I just kind of got here into this chair. Boom, just speaking that. Suddenly there's people in the room, you know. I live in my skull, you know. But you guys asked me to practice coming out, saying some prayers, direct my thinking. What would you have me be this day, this moment, right now? Judy?
Okay. Yeah, so it is an attitude. And I want to go back to this sentence. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. And I want to be the director of that. I want to show you what God can do. And instead, God's wanting to show you what he can do through me. So it's a whole different relationship. It really does describe the relationship to a power greater. We let him demonstrate through us. We let him. Not he's gonna, just because we asked. You know, you can ask, but if there's no action behind the asking. I had a sponsor who told me, she said, you can stay home and pray all day. It's not gonna do you any good. You don't do anything behind it. So, because I was into that, I've got to get up earlier. I've got to spend more time doing this. It's the time. I'm not spending enough time doing it. And what she explained to me was that it isn't the time. It's the focus when you do it, and it's the backup action after you do it. So, okay, so how do I be at work? Not sure whether, you know, you don't really know what people are thinking or what's going to happen next. And in my job, I never know. I just never know. You know, I'm not in a job where you go in and just do your work and go home. I'm in a job where it's, you know, it's the soup du jour of whatever the problem of the day is. And that's my job. So if I have a plan about something I want to get done, I need to be in there way before anybody else is there. If I have something I have to get done, because I need to do that. Because if I walk in there and don't have that done, and think I'm going to get that done in a day, I'm lying to myself. So, and I end up in that position more than I'd like. So what do I have to do? What is the real practice of this? So the practice is I have to breathe. I had somebody say that to me today. Breathe. And, sorry, I thought I'd turn that off. I have to breathe, and sometimes I have to walk away. In my early sobriety, I spent a lot of time in a lot of bathrooms on my knees. A lot of time. I wrote, I had in my pocketbook on index cards, the 11th step, what to do when we get agitated or doubtful. I wrote that out. I wrote the prayers out. Not because I couldn't remember them, because I got to tell you, I've read them millions of times. They're like etched in my brain. But it's the act of actually going into the bathroom, separating myself from the problem, going into the bathroom, taking the thing out of my bag and making myself read it, getting down on my knees and reading it. And it's those kinds of actions that are a statement of surrender, and it really does say, in my experience, to God, I'm ready for me to be out of the way and let you work through me. And I've had amazing transformations happen in my personality as a result of that in a day, in an hour. So it really does work, but it has to be, I see that as a promise. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. That's a promise to me. He absolutely will do that. But I have to ask, and I have to have some action behind it for it to have any impact on, for any transformation to occur inside of me and for me to appear and to actually be different. It's a state of being. It's not there's action involved, but what happens is a new state of being happens as a result of the action. Okay.
Now, about sex. Here we go. Page 68.
Y'all listening now. I said, here y'all get settled in your seats.
Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes. Absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is the lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiters of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? So I had the good fortune of going down to San Antonio for the World Convention in 2010, and there was a whole pack of young people running around in these black T-shirts with white letters that said "Straight Pepper Diet." It was fun to see, you know, and it's just a silly aside, but you know, what's the first thing we tell people? We don't want to be the arbiters of anybody's sex conduct. We want to stay out of this, but hey, no relationships first year. Got it? Anybody ever follow that? I didn't. I'll just speak for myself. But in this area, you know, so we've got resentments, fears, selfish sex conduct when we're drinking. You know, bones break, fenders bend, all sorts of calamities ensue. It's the sexual arena where I was carrying around a lot of that stuff I was going to take to my grave. A lot of that stuff I had a lot of shame around, a lot of self-recrimination, just self-loathing, things that I just, you know, it was just not going to see the light of day. What you guys have always cautioned me to do, and what I think that this paragraph is cautioning me to do, is just relax, take it easy. You know, we all have these issues. You know, the just like our all of our stories, the details are going to be different, but the basic elements of them are pretty similar. You know, we all do things that we wouldn't normally do when we're drinking. We say things, we do things. We behave in ways, and this is certainly one of those areas. So I'm not going to do a fifth step from the table tonight, but I will tell you that I carried around a lot of that stuff that I swore I was never going to tell anybody. Made it in a general way to my first fifth step, and then in the subsequent fifth step, my opening line to my sponsor when I sat down, because I had pages and pages of inventory But I couldn't stand it anymore. I just sat down and I said, here's the stuff I'm not even writing down. And I just dumped it, you know, for the first time in my life, word for word, act for act. Everything that I've been carrying around that I was going to take to my grave, I was finally free of in this context of the inventory and the fifth step. So it tells me, you know, it's easy to get way off the track. We avoid these extreme opinions. We just take it easy. And he's going to give us some specific instructions on what to do about them in a minute. Judy?
Okay, so I don't need to be the arbiter of anybody else's conduct, but I certainly do of my own. And that was not a practiced skill when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The good thing for me was that it wasn't a problem because I was a complete basket case when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't do anything, really. So I didn't realize it was a problem for many years after I was sober. And it's a very difficult thing to talk about. I think it scares people. It scared me in terms of doing a fourth step and doing a fifth step. We all have things that we'd like to forget we were ever involved in, and I'm no different. What we come to understand about that, what the first sponsor that I did a fifth step with said to me was, in regard to this and in regard to a lot of things, and it's very true, and I know it to be true. I didn't know it to be true when she said it to me. I had to accept it on faith, but I do know it to be true now. Is that I did not have an option. I didn't have another alternative. I did what I did because of the foundation I was standing on. And if I wanted something different, I needed a new foundation. And we talk over and over in our literature about pulling out the foundation we're standing on and rebuilding it. There's, you know, the word rebirth is used in the literature. What we're trying to do is create a new foundation. And she said to me, anything that you learned how to do, you can unlearn. So she really gave me an out and an option for changing. Really what she was saying to me is, change is absolutely required, but just the good news is you absolutely can do it. You can have a new attitude toward this. You can have a new life in this arena. If you're willing to inventory it and work toward it. And the other kind of general guideline she gave me was, she said, if you have to take your life and make one decision about it, and this is the decision. You cannot drag anything from your drunk life into your sober life. If you do, you're going to end up back in the drunk life. So whatever that landscape looks like, it has got to all change. So if you were promiscuous in your drunk life, you better not be in your sober life. You know, maybe that would work for you in your sober life if that wasn't the way you were drunk. Who knows? There's no judgment about that. But the fact is, if you do not create a new foundation and give yourself to God and ask God, give him this opportunity to develop you know, a way to be. You know, where do I want to go? What's the goal? Present it to God and ask him to help me go there. Just the way it says here, that's the prayer. And to subject to question myself about my current life using exactly what it asks here. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? You know, I had to say yes in all cases before I came here, because it was, absolutely. Because to be honest with you, I just was like this. I couldn't do anything but see me all the time. What I have, what I don't have, what you have, what I want that you have, you know, on and on and on. So was it selfish or not? I mean, that's a no-brainer. Of course it was. So we ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. you know, he can mold your, you can get an ideal, but can you live up to it? You know, that's the other thing. But I think I equate it very much to the same thing as drinking. I had an ideal of not taking a drink that I wanted to live up to. So it's that same surrender process. Just the way I surrendered everything to not drink, I have to surrender all of my ideas and all my demands and all my desires and all my expectations in this arena too, and ask God to help me live up to that. And if I can't, you know, if it becomes a particularly difficult thing, you know, I also like this qualifying statement that really is helpful to just human beings in general. We have to always remember that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. Because being of the nature and personality that I am, I can go one, you know, I want to go, I'm always going one direction or the other. You know, I'm, which in the fourth step, they talk about being on the bottom of the heap or the top of the heap. This is an ego thing. You know, if I've got to go treat it lightly, that's an ego thing. If I've got to do it selfishly, despise it or loathe it, you know, these are extremes. And always my extremes, if I am acting out extremes in my personality, that's my ego showing its ugly head. It's always the case. That is always a given that I've been able to rely on. So that tells me where I'm standing. Not only does it ask me the question, but it also gives me a way to measure what I'm doing, if I'm willing to do that. Thanks.
So it says, it gives us some very specific instructions for the inventory. We reviewed our conduct over years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. So I've got to get this down on paper. I found some interesting things that I'll share that I didn't expect to find. One of them was just the relative lack of any sort of long-term merit that stuff I was taking to the grave had to teach me. It was really just giving that up was enough for that to just dissipate and be filed away. But I did find an interesting thing. Yeah, I mean, this is almost a checklist here. Was it selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? You know, if I need to arouse jealousy or suspicion to get what I want, then I'll do that. You know, so that's by the very definition is selfish. If I want something, I'm going to manipulate the situation to get it. Whom had I hurt? I've got that in the top of my head. I can write those people down pretty quickly. But what I really kind of was amazed to learn was that, and I don't really like saying this out loud, and it's not particularly titillating, it's just kind of, I don't know, it's just awful to admit, that I had always thought that this activity, this sexual activity with women was a basic urge, basic procreation, it's certainly a human instinct and so forth. And I didn't look much farther than that. And what I found through the inventory, what I was after was self-esteem. What I was after was to feel good about myself. You know, if she says yes, if she sparkles at me, if she smiles and lights up when she sees me, I feel really good. That makes me feel really, really good. I feel accepted. I feel worthwhile. I feel like I'm worthy to be here, you know? So I don't want much from you, you know, other than to make me feel good about me. And that's, you know, you might notice that that's nothing like a relationship that doesn't really actually consider the other person at all. Not even a little bit. And so the other thing that I found too is this wonderful question, because over and over in my fourth column, selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate. And then I get to what should I have done instead? And I'm just like, I just do these things one at a time. And I'm like, and I'm a genius. And so I'm like, been unselfish? Maybe I should have told the truth? Maybe I should have considered the other person? And I found out something really interesting. When I consider you, when I pause and stop and think about you, and what your life is like, and what your struggles are, and who you are, when I stop and do that, the selfishness and dishonesty take care of itself. They just, like snow in June, man, they're just gone. So just a simple act of practicing consideration. I've got, this is totally not germane, but I'm going to throw, I got three boys, and I'm responsible to teach them what they need to know to go out in the world. And I tell my friends all the time, it's like, I don't know what to tell these boys other than basic human decency and kindness and condoms. And now I'm out of answers. I don't know any, I don't, you know, other than basic human decency, consideration for other human beings, and protect yourself physically. I don't know what else to tell them. So if anybody has any advice on that, I'll take it after the meeting. I think that's it for me. Okay. Oh, so should I read? Yeah. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we had done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific answer. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. You want to go?
Yeah, hysterical thinking or advice. My current sponsor believes in letting people have their own experience. And even if you think they might be doing something that's, you know, not, like they're going to go down the wrong path, and that's contrary to the way I had been sponsored. So I kind of like this better. But I will say this, that and God in his infinite wisdom put me with exactly the right person at exactly the right time, because I needed that kind of, I needed somebody to really just put some boundaries on me so I could function and get sober. And I outgrew that. So the person I'm with now is what happens, what that transition is about, is a relationship with God. And the self-esteem that David was just talking about comes from that relationship. The self-esteem that we're looking for. And I didn't know that. I don't think I would have known that if you said it to me, to be honest. I know it now out of experience, so I can say it and believe it and know it. And I think it's something that you have to experience and walk into and walk through and be in the middle of and live in to know what that's like, to have self-esteem as a result of being in a relationship with a power greater than yourself that's not a man, a human man, you know. However you view God, whatever. But yeah, self-esteem does not come from other people, you know. I can't get it from anybody else, and I spent my whole life trying to do that, you know. I lied all the time. I just acted out of total fear, like we talked about, of being alone. And boy, when acting out of that's the whole story. It sets in motion trains of circumstances. It just does, you know. I made a decision out of not wanting to be alone to marry the guy I married, and both of our lives are impacted out of that. My daughter's life is impacted out of that. Her daughter's, hopefully I'm having a grand daughter. I don't know yet, but that's what I hope. Her life's going to be impacted. You know, her husband's life is impacted. Everybody is impacted by that decision I made. And equally so are people's lives impacted by different decisions. And thank God, you know, God gives us another opportunity. That's kind of what sobriety is about. This is another opportunity. Here's another chance. And I have been faced with that over and over again at different milestones in my walk, and have been asked, not particularly by another person, but I've been faced with that question of, are you gonna keep walking? Are you gonna tell the truth? Are you gonna do the right thing in spite of how you feel, in spite of what you want, in spite of what you think? Are you gonna do the right thing? Because you know the right thing when it's presented to you. I've always known that. So are you going to do that? Or are you going to make a decision that's going to take a tiny twist in your character and send you down a road that's going to impact people's lives in ways you just can't even imagine? So the great thing about sobriety is, so now that I'm sober, what gets to happen are things, you impact people's lives in different ways. So so this ex-husband of mine that her father, who just a terrible, terrible drunk. No surprise, right? What's he doing with me? We've had a very rocky road in the time that we've been separated and divorced, and at my daughter's wedding. Our daughter's wedding. He was so, what you people did with me over the 25 years before that day had such an impact on him. He's been trying to get sober for the last year. He's got 3 months now. But I got to tell you, there's nothing I could have said to him, because I'll tell you, when I came to AA, I was trying to drag him in here. I thought if he would just get sober, this would all work. Nothing had the impact of just being with me for that wedding, for that few hours that had. And that took 25 years to put together. So it really made me know that this is a long haul deal. And if I want to do the right thing, I'm not going to give up on the short. I'm just not going to give in, you know? Just don't give up and don't give in. Don't run and don't drink. That was said to me over and over and over. And it's the same thing with all of these things. Don't give up on this. If you can't meet the ideal, just like it says in the fifth step, if you don't meet the ideal, does that mean you're going to drink? If we fall short, does that mean we're going to, you know, we're doomed? And I'm just going to kind of go on and read this here. This is what it says. If we're sorry for what we've done, have an honest desire to let God take us to better things. Let God take us. That's an important point. Let God take us to better things. We believe we will be forgiven and we'll have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience, and I absolutely believe that.
So to sum up about sex, he gives us some actions. We earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of our ourselves. No, I've lost my place. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. So there's some specific stuff in there. The one story that I tell just real quickly, and it's a wee little thing, but I'm flesh and blood. I'm a human being, you know, and I get my little infatuations and crushes like the next guy, you know, and And there was a time where I found this woman in AA was creeping into my morning meditation. And I would notice it and kind of enjoy it, you know. Wonder what she's doing. She's so pretty. And it just, you know, I'm married with children and so forth, and I don't want to spend any time with that, but it got to be something that I couldn't dismiss. And so I go, and I would read these pages. And it just basically said, if it's troublesome, to throw yourself into helping other people. And I made a little deal with myself. I was like, instead of calling her, I got to call 6 men, you know, and ask them how they're doing. And I just started calling men, talking to them. And that burns up some time and energy. And then you got to go to work, you know. So it was just a practical thing, and I'm just offering it, if anybody's in a similar boat, that we're never going to go wrong considering other people and what we can do to help them, instead of constantly considering what's going to make David feel better and happy and full of self-esteem. So in this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you're convinced now that God can remove from you whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you've already made a decision, third step, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, resentment, fear, and selfish sex conduct, you have made a good beginning. Beginning? That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. So that's how that ends. You want to sum up, or you want to close?
I think we can probably close it down.
That's us.
Okay. All right.
Thank you for your patience. Kind understanding.
We're
it's so hard to talk
these
about
baskets. I can't talk now. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Do we have announcements? Yes, sir.
Greg Alcoholic.
Greg!
49th Street Living.
Anybody else? Announcements? Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. We do have some literature on the table over there. We have some big hardcover big books. Please see any one of us if you'd like to purchase one of those. We would like to greet any newcomers that have never joined us before or might be at their first AA meeting. Is there anybody here tonight? Meets that. Yes, sir. Hey, Matt. Welcome.
Hi, Marlene.
Hey, Marlene. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Phyllis. First time at this meeting.
Hi, Phyllis.
Hey, Phyllis.
Welcome.
Thanks. Yes, ma'am.
Sarah.
Hey, Sarah. Okay, sponsorship question. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Would anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. Okay, see one of those folks if you need a sponsor. And in closing, I'd like to thank everybody for being here tonight and for setting up the room and making all this possible. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step we discussed tonight. All are welcome to attend the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Bella Pizza. And David has volunteered to read the last two paragraphs of 164.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Amen. Anybody like to join us in the Lord's Prayer?
Lord's Prayer. Clean up pizza.
I'm not going to do anything.